Michael Rauer.
Hello, Dottie. It's me, Scott C.
Where are you calling from?
Texas.
Where?
Honest. Listen, I'll prove it.
The stars at night are big and bright.
Deep in the heart of Texas.
It's time for the SAFTACast. I'm your host, Scott C. SAFTACast episode 40. We have hit the big 4-0. 40 episodes, and you are in it now with episode 40. I like saying episode 40 repeated times. It kind of buries the message in your head. Episode 40. Episode 40. We got a great one for you today. Jill Alexander Esbaum is with us on the program, and oh man, wait till you get into this one. Wait till you hear this one. But before we get into that, let me update you on some things from the Sundress Academy for the Arts and Sundress Publications. Sundress Publications dropped a new e-chapbook this week. Dan Crocker's This Is Where I Ruined Your Childhood is out now as a free e-chap download. If you go to sundresspublications.com, joining the ranks of some great, great poets and writers there. Free e-chap books and poetry to download from the likes of Corinna McGlynn, Jennifer Jackson Berry, Les Kay, and many others. A couple we've had on this program, but there are many more. Sundress is prepping a big announcement. I cannot tell you anything more about it, but I can tell you that when it drops, you can find out all the information by visiting the Sundress Publications website, but you can also visit the sundresspublications.com Facebook page by going to Facebook, typing in Sundress Publications. You can also type in and find the Sundress Academy for the Arts, Firefly Farms, which is the home of SAFTA, and you can find us there as well by searching SAFTACast. Go on. Go to these places, like us, and get all the latest news on things, because I can tell you there's a lot of events happening at Sundress. There are always things happening, and the best way, honestly, the best way to keep informed is by paying attention to the Facebook page, because it drops all the new info as fast as it comes out. You can also find them on Twitter. Sundress Publications is on Twitter, as well as many of the ancillary groups associated with SAFTA, such as SAFTA Films, the SAFTA Cookbook, and of course, yours truly, on the SAFTACast. You can find us at SAFTACast on Twitter. You can also, as I said, find us on Facebook. You can find all of us on Facebook, too. SAFTA Films, SAFTA Cookbook, the SAFTA Reading Series. All of it is on Facebook. Many of them are on Twitter. They are the single best ways to keep up to date with what is going on with the Sundress Academy for the Arts and the Sundress Publications. Much going on, much happening. There's much coming up from the SAFTACast as well. We've already started prepping our Christmas show ideas and such. And if you go to our Facebook page right now, you can comment with your idea for a Christmas holiday-themed show, because we're going to do two of them, as I said last episode, in December. But we don't know the topics yet, so we're trying to figure them out here as soon as possible so that we can get started on them as soon as possible. We've got some great episodes coming up, and we've also got an idea. We've got something we're working on for Valentine's Day weekend next year, but that's a ways off. We'll get to that soon enough. Right now, what I want to get to is this interview coming up with Jill Alexander Esbaum. Pleasure to have her on this program. We got to talking about a lot of great stuff here. Mutual interest in cults and American cults, religious cults, but also cultural cults. That's kind of awkward to say, but you probably know what I'm talking about. But we also talk about the allure of France and try and pin down what is it about France, what is it about Texas that makes them so lovable. We also talk a bit about basketball and the Houston Rockets. And Jill even gives me some writing advice and attempt to inspire me to get back into the world of writing and not just podcasting. But hey, I do enjoy the podcasting because I get to bring awesome interviews like this to you, especially ones that include Jill Alexander Esbaum, who is coming up right at you, 31 seconds right after the theme song. I'm doing pretty good. Just settling in after a long day of work, you know, and I get to chat with awesome people then in the evening. So,
yes.
So let me start this off really with the burning question that is on everyone's mind right now.
Okay.
When you go out to the theater, movie or otherwise, which armrest do you generally go for?
Do you know what? I don't go to the movie theater, and let me tell you why. I'm scared of it. Maybe scared is the wrong word. So when the lights go out, you're there, and you may be with somebody, but you're there by yourself. You know what I mean? Because all of a sudden, it's you experiencing the movie with your own self and whatever you bring into the movie with you. And I don't know, like in the last few years, whatever I bring into the movies with me is a whole lot of angst and sort of a personal iniquity and drama. And a lot of times I just feel real guilty that I'm at the theater. Like I should be someplace else. And this sounds so stupid, but like helping orphans or, you know, I just feel like it's like a luxury that I shouldn't be enjoying. But then also it's just the darkness I don't really like. It took a long time for me to be able to sleep in total darkness, and sometimes I still can't do it. So I just don't like to go to the movies that much.
It took you a long time to get used to sleeping in total darkness. Did you like have one light on, or was it like just a nightlight that you would need? Or
well, it took me a long time. Well, I have a tendency to insomnia anyway until maybe the last couple of months, and I'm not lying here. Until the last couple of months, from the time I was maybe about 17 till, and I'm over twice that age, I don't want to say how old I am, but I'm old. And at least once a week for all those years, I've stayed up like an entire night. So that's like, I did the math once. That's something like a year's worth of missed sleep, and not a year of nights. That's like a year.
So 525,600 minutes?
Something like that. I don't.
I only know that because of Rent.
Right. I don't know. I did the math. Maybe I did the math wrong. But it's a fuck ton of sleep that I've missed. And so I just don't sleep very well. And only recently I've been able to sleep better. So I don't know what that's about, except I'm good at sort of understanding my sleep cycle. I think partly it's, I don't think I operate on a 24-hour circadian rhythm. Is that it? I don't think I operate on a 24-hour day. I think maybe like my day is more like 28 hours. And that's my cat. Sorry. He doesn't like it when I'm talking to other people. So then like at one point in the week, I'm, you know, it's 4 a.m. and I'm not sleepy, right? Because it's, I have like a stutter step where I have to catch up. I don't know. But anyway, so I have a hard time sleeping and my mind is sort of always going. And some of the things that I'm interested in are kind of scary. And so, I don't know, I don't want to turn the light off because that's when the scary stuff happens.
And that's sound logic, in my opinion. Darkness is where the scary stuff is. What, when you say, though, that you're interested in, like, disturbing stuff, what are you talking about?
Well, lately, I've been watching a lot of things. This is so bad. I don't watch a lot of TV, but I watch a lot of stuff on YouTube. And I watch like a lot of, you know, because people upload all their TV programs that they, I guess they TiVo on there. So I can like glut on all the Datelines I want to. So I think I've seen every single Dateline that's ever been uploaded to YouTube and also like all the 48 hours. And then that sends me down the road of like all the serial killers and all the murderers and then like all of these crimes that people don't know of that much or natural disasters or things like that. So I know a lot about serial killers and murderers and crime I'm interested in, but I'm also interested in lately. Do you ever listen to like Coast to Coast AM?
I know of it, but I don't think I've listened to it in ages.
Okay. Well, there's this guy who's on there quite a lot right now. And he writes about people who go missing in national parks. And apparently, like a shit ton of people go missing in national parks under weird circumstances. So I've read all of his books, and some of his evidence is kind of compelling, and some of it's kind of, I don't buy it, but enough of it's compelling to be very scary. But he's also a Bigfoot researcher, and he doesn't seem to, he won't say what he thinks it is, but I don't think he believes it's Bigfoot. But because I've read all of these books, I'm also sort of into Bigfoot right now. And Bigfoot isn't as scary as the other stuff, but it is also a little bit scary.
What about the, have you seen the reports of the New Jersey Devil being photographed?
Yeah, that is pretty scary stuff too, although I don't buy the photograph.
It looks too much like a stuffed animal being thrown in the air.
It does. I also don't buy the photographs of Bigfoot for the most part. I think that there's a reason we've never seen one. Mostly it's because they're good at hiding. I think that catching one on video is going to be really difficult, but there's other evidence.
There's other evidence. I don't know. My mind's not made up yet on it. I've never been too big on cryptozoology, though. The Loch Ness Monster are pretty much at this point.
Yeah, that's the only cryptoid I'm really interested in is Bigfoot, because I don't find it like it's not like a paranormal thing. You know, it's not something that exists, you know, in a different dimension. It's not, you know, something with supernatural powers. It's just something that there's probably very, very few of, and that's very, very good at hiding. You know, if I was a Bigfoot, I wouldn't want to come out.
I could see the desire to hide, especially in the Great North Woods.
Mm-hmm.
Humankind is kind of dangerous.
Kind of.
Especially when you've been reading about serial killers and such. What is fascinating about serial killers? Because you're not alone in the obsession of that.
No, I'm not. I've talked with my psychoanalyst about this to great length. And it's really funny. When I'm especially anxious, one of my go-tos is sort of watching a lot of documentaries on serial killers. And you would think that that would make me more anxious. And it kind of doesn't. It kind of settles me down a little bit. And I don't think it has to do with, wow, their problems are much worse than my problems. I think it has to do with solving a puzzle. You know, like when people read murder mysteries, they try to, you know, find out who did it or like why they did it. So I think it has to do with like solving a puzzle of maybe the riddle of the human psyche or something. Like, I don't know. I haven't gotten that far in figuring it out. I kind of don't want to know what the magic trick is, because then it won't work anymore. But I guess I've always been pretty, my parents were very, you know, don't take candy from strangers. We don't go trick or treating because, you know, there'll be razor blades and apples and things like that. So my parents were always very suspicious of people. So I have a healthy suspicion of shady characters, but you know, not all murderers are shady characters.
No, you look at some of the most devious of American history in 20th century, especially.
Bundy,
very charming.
Very, very handsome man. And he got by on his charm. And if you look at, like, for example, Jim Jones, who is probably the greatest mass murderer in American history, Jim Jones. You know, that wasn't, you know, 900 suicides. That was one suicide and 900 some odd murders. He was incredibly charismatic. And, you know, he got by on all his charm, too. So, you know, it's not just, it's easy to, like, point out the scruffy, scary types, but it's these other ones. You gotta...
Yeah, you know, a rock star can get you to buy his album, but Jim Jones got 900 people to die for him.
Exactly. Exactly. And I just recently listened to, there's a podcast that I've been listening to lately. I can't remember the name of it, but it goes into a lot of crime stuff. And they played, like, the tapes of right after the congressman had been shot. And so it was when Jim Jones is telling people that they're going to, and it wasn't Kool-Aid, just so you know, it was Flavor Aid, mostly grape, when he was explaining his revolutionary suicide to people. And some people were fighting him on it. And the other people were saying, you know, Father, because they had him call him Father. Father's been good to us. You know, he's added years to our life. We need to lay our life down for him. And other people were fighting him on that. And listening to those tapes, it's just eerie.
It's available for download for free on the internet, actually.
You can totally find it.
The full 45 minutes. I have it, and I've been able to listen to, I think, about 15 seconds of it. It's disturbing.
It's really disturbing. That is disturbing.
I just can't deal with it for some reason. And yet I'm fascinated with the massacre and studying it.
Oh, yeah. I heard an interview. There's a few people, very few people escaped it. And I heard an interview recently. There's a woman who wrote a book about it. I can't remember her name, but it just came out not that long ago. And her story of how she escaped that day, and her story of she grew up in the People's Temple. So she was pretty young. I mean, she was maybe like 18, I guess, or 20. So she was very young. Her mom and her sister and her family all died that day. But it was horrifying.
Yeah, there was a documentary a few years ago on, I want to say it was History Channel, that had his son on there.
Mm.
From his point of view, he renounced everything of the family, basically, if I recall. But was finally coming out and like, here's the story from my side of it as the son.
Oh, yeah. It's a terrible, terrible thing.
Again, the obsession with it, not just you, but a cultural thing. Do we watch these things? Do we obsess over them as a way to kind of put things in perspective? like on the daily news and kind of stuff? Like, well, it could be worse.
Well, I think a lot of us pay attention to it. Well, I'm going to say I hate lumping myself into this, but I think people pay attention to it because, you know, it's like porn, you know, it's let's watch this and get a thrill out of it. But I hope that people pay attention to this stuff, you know, because we can learn from it. You know, it's fucked up shit. We should learn from fucked up shit so that we can make sure fucked up shit doesn't keep happening.
And yet it still does.
Of course it does, you know. It's the nature of mankind. It's who we are. Is we live on a fallen planet, and happens. But yeah, I think that people, you know, there's that aspect of this train's about to crash. Or I mean, you know, the train's already crashed. I mean, we can't do anything about it. It's already happened. Yeah. Watching it is so shocking. I mean, we go to horror movies. We ride roller coasters. We like to be shocked.
We like to dare the nightmare, as Stephen King puts it.
Yeah, totally.
Now, Wes Craven, who recently passed away, put it as that you go to horror movies because there you can get out the demons in your head, the things you're really afraid of, in a controlled environment, basically. They're on screen, so if you're afraid of clowns, you go see about a killer clown movie as a way to kind of go, ah, there it is, I can face it, I can confront it, and it's controlled, and it's make-believe.
That's really smart. I have to think about that. Maybe that's why I like the serial killer stuff, but I don't know. I have to think about that.
Maybe it's there on the TV. It's not in the house. It's on the TV, and you're separated by the glass.
It's true.
I don't know. I've wondered about it because I love 80s slasher movies.
Uh-huh.
Because they're stupid, in my opinion. They're just absolutely ridiculous. But I was at a group, hanging out with a group of purported movie fans, and they looked at me when I was explaining, like, why Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street are so interesting, especially in terms of feminism and what's going on in 80s conservative culture and politics. And I remember one person looked at me and said, are you wanted by the FBI? And I was like, just because I'm fascinated with this sub-genre of horror?
That's really funny.
Anyway, you mentioned your parents. I think you grew up where, in Texas?
I grew up in Texas.
Where in Texas?
Well, I was born in Bay City, Texas. And then we lived in a place called Alvin, Texas for a while, but we moved to Missouri City, Texas. These are all places nobody's ever heard of. But then we moved back to near Alvin to this little tiny town called Manville. But I went to Alvin High School. And what's funny about that is because my husband is named Alvin.
So you grew up in small town Texas then?
Small town Texas.
That must have been a trip.
Well, you know, these places were not, you know, podunk in that, like, I mean, like, you know, Alvin's maybe half an hour outside of Houston, but it's between Houston and Alvin is a lot of nothing in some spots. I mean, now it's more built up, but yeah, you know, I kind of liked it. I've only ever lived in Texas and Switzerland, so I can't really imagine living anyplace else. I don't know, just Texas feels like home to me.
I was about to say, what is it about Texas that makes you not want to leave Texas? And I'm not knocking Texas.
No. And I don't know that I would say it's that I don't want to leave Texas. It's that I feel like it's home. I feel like I understand the way that, like, a Texan mentality. I think it's a very friendly place. You know, I don't agree with a lot of the politics. You know, I live in Austin. You know, Austin's a very different place than Dallas, for example. But no matter where you go in Texas, it's very easy to find friendliness, no matter who you are.
So is it easy to fall in love with Texas?
I think it's easy to fall in love with Texans.
Maybe not the state, but the people.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the state is a pretty damn big place. And a lot of the places are not particularly, you know, lovely in terms of, like, I honestly can't stand Houston or Dallas. San Antonio is real nice. I like it a lot. But Austin is a neat place, and I like these little small towns, and I don't know, I feel Texan. Whatever that means, I feel it.
I can even hear it a little bit in the accent.
Yeah.
Just a touch of it.
Yeah.
Do you feel that way about small towns wherever you go? Small town is generally better than the big city?
No, I don't think so. We just came back from Europe, and my favorite place on the planet is Paris. I mean, I don't think there's a city that beats it. And I mean, that's an enormous place. So, but also we spent some time in a very small town in France, which was also really cool too. So You know, it just depends on where you're at. So is it always just depends on the people you're around? You know, you make your own home wherever you're at.
How old were you when you first went to Paris?
I was 17.
17, so teenager. Did you fall in love with it immediately, or did it take time?
Immediately. I was so excited when I started high school to take French. That was the one class I always wanted to take because I was a Francophile. And that was my major in college. And then I went back to France in college, and I've been back a few times since then. And, you know, I lived in Europe and I went to France as often as I could. And I don't know, just I like it. Alvin said he's never seen me so happy as I was like 3 weeks ago when we were in France.
There's just something about France, just something. Can't explain it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's the language. I love speaking French. I like riding the metro. I don't know. I like the way the bus exhaust smells. That sounds really stupid, but I just like listening. I don't know. I like it. I like the way the sun shines on the old buildings.
Sometimes it can't be explained, can it?
What's that? No, sometimes it can't be explained. You're right.
I can't explain why is it that I love New York City like I do, or New Orleans, my two favorite American cities. I don't know why I love them.
See, I find New York very difficult. I still can't, and I've been there plenty of times, but I enjoy it always so much more if I'm there with somebody who knows it really, really well. You know, I've never been able to be there on my own and appreciate it. On the other hand, Chicago, I really love, and I've been there plenty of times by myself. And, but, you know, it's just your personality and whatever you're attached to.
You gravitate toward where you gravitate toward. So you've done a lot of traveling then in your life, seemingly all over. How did you wind up living in Switzerland?
I moved there with the man I used to be married to so he could study psychoanalysis.
How long were you in Switzerland?
I was there for 2.5 years.
What did you think? Was it nice there, or were you ready to leave?
I lived in Zurich, and it was very, very difficult, but I got a novel out of it.
Hey, that's always what matters. Your first novel, which just came out this year, yeah, Hausfrau.
It came out in March, and it did pretty good. It's coming out in 24 countries so far, so I can't complain.
No, can't. I don't think anyone could complain with that.
No, it's that's the long way around saying, as awful as it was, I certainly wouldn't trade it for anything. The Swiss are complicated people.
How so?
Switzerland is sort of governed by a lot of rules. Like, for example, you're not allowed to be noisy after a certain time of day. I can't remember if it was like 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock. And like, you can't work on your car or mow the lawn. And then you can't do it at all on Sunday because it's a rest day. It's a quiet day. You know, which sounds like, you know, when you're in elementary school, it's quiet time, right? And you have to tie up your recycling in a certain way or it won't be picked up, and put it in a certain place on the, you know, curb or it won't be picked up. And, you know, there's just all of these rules that you have to follow. Even just before you can come into the country, there was this huge, giant checklist that we had to go through. And some of them were really contradictory, like you couldn't, I don't remember if it was insurance or like an Ausweis, a residence permit, but like one or two or maybe both, you couldn't get like a residence permit unless you had a bank account, but you couldn't get a bank account unless you had a residence permit. So it's like, and I don't even remember how we were able to do that, but you know, there's all these hoops that you have to jump through. It's a beautiful country. It's incredibly clean. But it's very, there's this idea that like the Swiss, you know, we think it's cliche about like the knives are really sharp and precise and the clocks run on time. Well, that's not a cliche. I mean, it may be a cliche, but all of that is exactly true. So if there's any part of you that has sort of like a side that's like lax or maybe a little bit flighty or something, they're just going to have a hard time there.
I was reading an article recently about the Swiss guard that protect the Pope, and some people might laugh, like, oh, Swiss guard, ha ha ha. No, they're some of the most badass secret forces on the planet.
Totally. There's a whole bunch of hoops they have to jump through to be able to be one. You have to be like a certain age, and like, I want to say like a certain height and weight, and you have to be Catholic, of course, speak, you know, the right language and stuff. But yeah, But don't get me wrong, it's definitely a beautiful country, and I wouldn't trade my experience there for the world. I mean, you know, novel aside, I totally believe that if you're happy at any place in your life, you have to also look to the crappy points in your life and embrace those, because you're not the person you are without the shit.
Every experience makes you who you are the next minute that you live.
Completely. Completely. And it's the most important time of my life, simply because it was miserable. And anyway, we were back in Switzerland, Alvin had never seen it, so I took him when we were in Europe, and it was a really nice time. I was a little worried it was going to be icky because I was so anxious about going, but we just had a great time, and we ate a lot of ice cream and just had a blast.
So it's really the company that you're with, ultimately, that can change that. I had that with Chicago. My first visit to Chicago was a miserable experience.
Did you live there?
No, I visited, but I had just broken up with somebody, and it was a trip that neither of us could get out of, and we both had to go on. And so it was kind of a miserable experience in that way. But a couple years later, I went back, and since then I've grown okay with Chicago. We're cool now.
Right. Well, maybe, you know, like, I think you're right. And, like, going back to, like, Texas, for example, like, maybe I misspoke. I can see living someplace else if the opportunity came up, but I don't really imagine it because right now this is home. This is where the people I love live. You know what I'm saying? It's like, since it's always been where the people that I love live, that's what makes it home.
It's not just land. It's home.
It's not just land. It's home. You know, it's where my shoes are and, you know.
There's no dust like Texas dust.
Oh my gosh, it's so true. There's no pollen like Texas pollen.
And Texas sandstorms?
That is not something we have over here in the hill country, but yes, apparently the more west you go, it's horrendous.
Out near El Paso and such.
Yeah, Laredo, all that stuff. I've never been out there, never stayed out there, but I guess at certain points in the windy season or whatever, it's pretty dang miserable.
Where else have you traveled in this world? Because you've been all over the place. You've been to Europe. Have you been to the other continents?
Next week, actually, we're going to Taiwan.
Interesting. Have you been there before?
Nope. My husband's Taiwanese. We're going with the whole family to meet the family that, well, they already know the family that lives over there, but I don't know the family that lives over there still. His immediate family all live in America, and he was born in Taiwan, but all the rest of the family live in Taiwan. And I've never been to Asia, so.
Looking forward to it then.
Yeah, we're going to ride in. So Ava Air, which I guess is the Taiwanese airline, they have 4 airplanes that are Hello Kitty airplanes.
Yes.
And one of the flights leaves Houston. So we're taking a Hello Kitty airplane from Houston to the Hello Kitty terminal in Taipei.
Already the trip is magical.
Already it's magical. It's just, yeah, I don't even know what to say about that.
I don't think you can say anything about it, really.
There's nothing to say about that. I'm not sure what, I mean, like, the airplane is one thing, but the terminal. You got to Google that. But no, I haven't really, I've just traveled in Europe. I mean, I've traveled around the States a little bit, but, I mean, more so actually recently since this book came out, because I've done a little bit of touring here and there, but not really that much. I'm kind of a weird homebody, but I used to go to a lot of concerts, and I used to go to a lot of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds concerts. And so I would, and when I was in Europe, I used to sort of follow him on tour a lot of times. So I've been to a bunch of different cities in Europe.
With the tour shirts to prove it.
With the tour shirts to prove it, yes.
The battle scars. So I think, Jill, you are the first guest we've ever had on here who has a Master's of Divinity.
It's a Master's in Religion.
It's a Master's in Religion. How'd you wind up on that path?
Well, I also have a Master's in English, but after I got my Master's here at UT, I felt like maybe I had a calling to the ministry. And so I started the seminary here, Austin. But when I was there, my first book of poems got published. And it was a little sort of racy, and I just sort of realized that I didn't have the same kind of calling maybe as the other people did, because I really think that, like, once you put on a collar and you profess to speak for an entire body of people, you know, I'm going to speak for, you know, the Lutherans or the Episcopalians or whatever, like, you really do need to speak for them and not for yourself. That puts a muzzle on you in a certain way that I don't think as a writer you need to have. And it's very disrespectful to swear allegiance maybe to one thing and then push your own agenda. Do you know what I mean?
I see what you're saying, yeah.
By that, I do not at all intend to mean that when you're working within a body of religion and something's wrong, you shouldn't work to change it. That's not what I'm saying at all, because you should, and people do all the time. But you also have to remember that you're not just speaking for yourself. You're speaking for the entire community. It's a slower moving beast than a single person.
It's a lot of responsibility then.
It's a huge responsibility, and that one doesn't belong to me.
So what did you feel like the calling was for you ultimately?
That's to be a writer, you know, just to write and to see what happened. And I finished my degree, and that's why I made the distinction between divinity and religion, because I didn't get an MDiv, so I'm not, you know, on a path to be ordained. But I have a master's in religion, so I know a lot about religion. Actually, I sort of followed the path of, I studied a lot about American religion, and so I know a lot about cults, and that was sort of what I wanted to learn about.
Specialization.
Yeah.
Like, I have a master's in religion, specialization in cults.
And cults, and also like sort of organic American religion. I studied a lot about Pentecostals and Amy Semple McPherson. Yeah.
We come right back to Jim Jones then with the cult thing.
Yeah, you do.
And there is something fascinating about cults, not only religious, but cultural cults as well. The cult culture that we create.
Well, like, we do. I mean, we make idols of so many things, you know. We were laying in bed the other day, and I was futzing around on my computer, and I was annoyed because you used to could, like, pull up Yahoo as a homepage and be able to, like, get actual news on it. But, like, I didn't even scroll all the way to the bottom, and there were 10 stories about the fucking Kardashians before I hit the bottom of the page. Like, 10 stories. And I was like, this is fucking ridiculous. And everybody I know is sick of hearing about these people, and yet we hear about them because we've elevated them to, you know, status of cultural icon or idol. And why? There's absolutely not anything interesting that they have to say, and yet they're reflective of what's going on in our culture.
Cult of personality.
Completely, you know. And I don't know if this is true anymore, but at one point, like, one of them was the person who had the most followers on Twitter, maybe, and you know, having like the reality TV show and being involved with the people they're involved with. I don't know. But yeah, so something like that, for an example, is what we pay money for and what we pay attention to is what we value.
Yeah, and we have also, beyond that, the cult of celebrity. We've got just, we use the term cult movies.
Totally.
How it suddenly becomes almost religion. In some cases, it does become religion. You have Jediism in Britain.
Yeah, I was thinking about that the other day.
Actual Star Wars religion now.
Yeah, you know, and I'm not saying that, you know, I don't certainly have things that I put too much emphasis on, probably, and there's things that I really, really like and care about, and there's certainly things that all of us do, but it's certainly ain't the Kardashians at my house.
What do they provide our society with?
Well, they're pretty. I mean, you know, there's that. I don't know. I don't even know. I don't even know what the TV show is, if it's even interesting. I mean, I've seen episodes of it a long time ago, but I don't remember it being particularly interesting.
I ask my students sometimes to say, what value do the Kardashians have? I mean, do they contribute anything to society and the betterment of mankind? Okay, Bill Gates, he developed software, but then he goes on to become a major philanthropist and is fighting disease and trying to make the world better. What did they do?
Well, I mean, certainly one argument is the whole Bruce Jenner's transition into Caitlyn Jenner. That's brought a lot of light onto transitioning and transgender and all the issues that people have had in the past, bullying, and what did he say? There was a an interview recently. Steve and I said he, where she said that she used to not believe in gay marriage, and now she's rethought it. So all these conversations are coming up, which wouldn't have come up before because what? Who's paying attention to Bruce Jenner, right? Who's going to pay attention to Bruce Jenner becoming Caitlyn Jenner?
Good point. It had been a long time since, and I'm going to use he here because it was he at the time.
Exactly.
He had been in the spotlight for sports.
He was off the radar. Then he was on the radar with the Kardashians. So when he transitioned to Caitlyn Jenner, that was maybe, I mean, so I'm trying to think, like, when you ask what's the value, that would be, you know, one thing I can think of.
That's a good argument. I know they're in the news today because
Lamar Odom,
yeah, was found unconscious in a brothel in Vegas, and Chloe, I think it is, like, went with a camera crew to his hospital room.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
I'm like, okay, now that's it. I'm like many people, I'm just like, that's it. I'm walking away now. And I mean, just out of culture. I'm done. What will be our breaking point? I don't know.
Well, we've been following this because we're NBA fans, and we're just a little bit interested. This is going to sound awful, but my husband collects, we have a lot of NBA memorabilia and stuff and a lot of jerseys. He'll do auctions, like a lot of times internet auctions or eBay auctions, and we have some jerseys and stuff. But at some point we had a suit that belonged to Lamar Odom, like a strange tuxedo. I don't know if we still have it at this point. So it was weird when we saw this. I was like, did you see this today? He's like, I know. But I didn't get a chance to ask him if we still had that suit.
When it comes to, well, you're an NBA fan. When it comes to the NBA, I'm guessing the Houston Rockets?
Oh, yeah, that's our team.
In the annals of basketball, will it always be Houston is your favorite? Or is there, like, the 90s Chicago Bulls or someone higher than the...
I grew up watching basketball with my dad. I fell in love with basketball when Hakeem Olajuwon, when Hakeem was on the Rockets. He's my all-time favorite player. In fact, I'm looking at a little figurine of him right now on my desk. So I think that, I mean, my team is the Rockets. And I was thinking about that the other day. I'm like, what would make me not love the Rockets if, I don't know, if like the owner started burning crosses on his lawn or something? I mean, if, you know, something, if they really stood up and said they stood for something that I didn't believe in, you know, I think you need to remain loyal to your team. I don't, even if they're playing badly, you know, that's my team. I love them, even if I yell at them, which I often do.
How do you stay loyal to a team when they're sucking? I'm not saying, because I don't know if the Rockets are sucking.
No, you remind yourself that times do change and it's noble to be loyal. You know, I love my cat when he misses the cat box.
A good comparison.
I don't know if that's a good comparison or not. But,
well, I'm thinking, you know, my fandom in sports is the Buffalo Bills, and the last time we were in the playoffs was 2000. And last time we did anything significant in the playoffs was when Clinton was in office.
But you still love them.
And I don't know why.
Well, see, you don't need to know. I mean, like, loyalties run deep. You know, I don't think you need to know why. It's sports. I don't know. I've been thinking about sports a lot over the last couple of years because I don't really, you know, I think they're important. And I don't know why. Like, I don't really understand, like, why they're important. But I think they are. I think it's important, like, maybe it has to do with, like, it's little battles, you know? Maybe it has to do with, like, it's a place where I can get my aggression out without, you know, actually having to fight somebody. Maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just, you know, the drama of it. Or maybe it's just good to have something to root for. I don't know.
Almost archetypal. You know, you look at the away team or the opponent as evil and your team as good, and so it's... You're watching it with the sense of a classic good and evil battle?
Maybe. I don't know. I've tried to... I'm sure it's been written on, and, you know, I've thought about it, but clearly not enough to go and search it down. But I know it's good for kids to play sports, you know? So it does something to children, like, when they play sports. Like, you know, it teaches them things. So it must continue, like, when you're adults. I don't know.
What do you think it brings into your life? Obviously, it's something that you and your husband can bond over.
Yes, he says I yell too much. I think I don't know. It does. One thing it does is to get my. I do know it helps me get my aggression out because it's really hard for me to not get all excited when I'm watching a game, and I do like the strategy of it, and I like it when the ball goes through the little hoop.
There's nothing like swearing at a television, especially at a ref call.
Totally swearing at the TV. That happens so much, and then I just get all. I'm just like I can't look at it. You know,
or you sit in there and you're like, I got to see that on replay right now. All right.
I got to see that on replay right now.
Okay. I can see why they're calling that a foul. Fuck you anyway.
Totally. And I've got a lot of friends who are basketball fans, and we have a lot of friendly rivalries. And I think that's good too. Maybe that's what's healthy about sports is the friendly rivalries and learning how to keep them friendly.
I find it fascinating when intellectuals are fascinated with sport. Because there's this stigma we have in society of, oh, if you're a smart person, you shouldn't like sports.
That's so interesting because some of the best like writing I've ever read has been about sports. I just read this book. I can't remember the name of the guy who wrote it. And it was a basketball book, The Breaks of the Game. I think that's the name of it. It's fantastic. I don't know. I don't even consider myself an intellectual, but yeah, I know what you mean. It's like that's something that people who aren't smart do.
I think it's like the high school strata of, okay, the nerds, they don't like sport.
Yeah, that's really sad, I think.
There's something to enjoy in it, whatever it may be. It trips you. Of your memorabilia, what do you consider to be like your showpiece? The prized possession?
Well, so I have a pair of sweatpants that James Harden wore in the All-Star game in 2013. So I like to put them on and write poetry. So I can say I write poetry in James Harden sweatpants, which I'm pretty sure nobody else gets to say.
And somebody can always ask you, it's like, how did you get into Harden's pants?
Yeah, that's true. But apparently it's not very difficult. I don't know. He has a reputation.
If there was one piece of sports of basketball memorabilia and money is no object, what's the piece de resistance would you most want for your collection?
Oh my gosh. I don't know. You know what I would love to do? I've told Alvin this. I would love to freaking coach the Rockets for a day because I really feel like I can fix some shit.
Okay, so, you know, like a silent auction kind of thing where they, you know, a charity auction thing.
Yes, I would like to coach them for a day because I feel like I could fix some shit.
You just want to be under contract for one day so you can retire as a Houston Rocket.
Just a day, yeah. And they have to be under contract to listen to what I say. But that would make me happy. Also, I wouldn't mind being like a color commentator for a day. That'd be kind of fun.
It is truly a fun thing to be on the mic.
Yeah, that'd be fun. I'd like that.
So that would be your dream. What about a tangible object that you could have in your collection to display at home?
Oof, gosh. I'd really have to think about that because there's so many. It's, you know, I do like jerseys. So, and I do have, I mean, Hakeem is my favorite, but I also, you know, let's just face it. There's a lot of cute basketball players out there and I do like the cuties. So I don't know, maybe some cute basketball player wore. I have a pair of Danny Green shoes. I like him. And I have a Donatas Motiejunas jersey that he wore in his Christmas Day game a couple years ago. And he's one of my favorite Rockets. But yeah, I don't know. I really have to think about that. Maybe like a net from like a winning game or something, you know?
Maybe the basketball and the famous Jordan pose where he's in mid-flight with the legs spread.
That'd be kind of cool. That'd be kind of cool.
Own that piece.
Yeah. Yeah, something neat.
Do you frequent sports memorabilia auctions? Are you on eBay constantly stalking?
No, I don't. And we haven't been doing it in a while. We used to go to more games, but you know, last year when I was trying to get the manuscript ready to publish, like I lost the whole year to doing edit. not edit so much, but like, because I didn't really have to do many edits, but like copy edits and stuff. And then it was just really stressful. So we didn't do a lot of basketball last year. And when I was not doing book stuff, I was doing work stuff. And when I was not doing that, I was doing, you know, being nervous about work stuff and book stuff. And then there was a lot of just trying to recoup from all that stuff and hold my shit together. I mean, you know how it goes.
Oh, yeah.
Writing is hard on one sense, but it's not hard like coal mining. I mean, like, you don't die from writing. You know, like, I get it. But, you know, there's a certain sort of mental togetherness. I mean, like, you've got to have your shit together. Yeah, part of that is, like, learning where to draw your line.
Brain sweat, basically.
Brain sweat. That's a really good word. I got to remember that.
There is that impression from people who don't write that, oh, you have an easy job as a writer.
Right. And again, it's not coal mining. You don't die. But I don't have a lot of weekends all the time because I have stuff I need to do. You know, it's not something that I can say. I mean, if I was, I suppose, like, if I was better at it, I could say, you know, from this point to this point is when I work, and then the rest is the time I'm off. But, you know, I'm not great about that. So I sort of feel like, you know, if I'm not working or if something isn't finished, then I'm on call, you know.
It's not done yet.
It's not done. So why am I not in there working on it?
Yeah, I've still got a job to do.
Exactly.
We just don't have a time clock next to us to punch in and out of.
Completely. I don't. Yeah. And until it's finished, it's not finished. So I don't know. I told Alvin that I have to work. And I actually do. When we're in Taiwan, I'm going to have to work because I teach in a low-res program. And, you know, I have stuff for them and assignments for them while I'm gone and lectures and videos and all this stuff prepared. But I still don't want to, like, be gone for 2 weeks without touching base. But I can't just completely go.
I think as writers, when we, no matter where we are, we can't completely turn off the job.
No, you can't. And I wouldn't either. You know, I usually never leave. I never go anywhere without like a digital recorder. And if I forget it, I always have my phone, right? Which I have a digital recording little program on it. You know, if I have like an idea or, you know, a line or something, you know, I put that fucker down right then because you're going to lose it if not. And that's made everything much easier. But even so, like at some point you're going to have to sit down and type that shit up.
You may hear a great title somewhere, but if there's no poem to go with the title.
I'm just going to write a book of titles one of these days.
Actually, that's, I won't get into my own writing, but my wife suggested that I do that for every one of my books, is include a list of titles, because I have files of, like, hundreds of titles I've come up with. And she's like, every one, you should just include one, like, at the end of the book, a collection of unused titles for that particular volume.
That's really smart. That's actually a poem. Just call the poem a list of titles. The titles I didn't write poems for, the poems I only got as far as the titles. I don't know. There's like a clever title in there somewhere.
But yeah, we've joked about that idea and many other things with me, but bah, I'm kind of in exile about writing and everything right now. But.
Well, yeah, that's a whole nother conversation. You can have that conversation and you can edit that part out too. But writing is, I'm having to teach myself how to write again.
What do you mean by that? You have to teach yourself how to write again.
So, like, one of the questions that, like, people keep asking me when I get interviews now is, like, so, what are you working on? Can we expect another novel? And I totally want to write one. I'm, like, I'm on board with that, like, 100%. Writing prose is cool because people read that shit. But it's like, what am I supposed to write about? I'm not going to write, like, you know, part two of this. You know, you can't copy yourself. Like, that's, you can't copy yourself because you're going to be called out on that. So it's like, what am I going to write? And I don't have any ideas. So I've had to, like, scrape the idea barrel. I took myself on, like, a writing retreat this past weekend with, like, some hotel points that I had. And I just stayed in, like, a hotel room and I didn't leave for like 3 days, and I had all these journals with me and like books that looked interesting, and I just spread them out on the second bed and just read, and then I'd type for a while and then I'd be like, well, that's interesting, and then I'd read some more and then I'd stop and I'd listen to like something interesting on the internet or like a podcast, and then I'd sleep for a little bit. And trying to like train myself in like a different voice so I'm not copying myself, and also to like loosen like some sort of corset stay so that I can just write something and it's okay if it sucks, because I can always go back and make it gooder, or I can just write a whole book and it doesn't matter if it sucks because it's just my time. And if I writing something is better than writing nothing. And I tell my students that all the time. So I don't know why I'm not listening to my own advice, because it's good. Do you know, I mean, you know what I mean, right?
Oh yeah, totally. Scraping the idea barrel. And you don't want to go back on your old work, kind of. You don't want to write a sequel.
Completely. You don't want to write in the same voice. And like, I am actually about 85% sure that this thing that I just started is entirely unpublishable. There will be nothing salvageable of it. And yet I got to see this through, because I don't have anything else I can work on right now. I mean, I'm trying to finish a book of poetry, and that is almost done. But this prose thing, I got nothing else right now. But if I don't do it, then I'm not doing anything.
And doing nothing is worse than doing bad crap.
Yes, because I was actually in analysis today, and I told her, I said, at least I can, even if it's not a good narrative, I can practice on making my prose good.
Some good will come out of it.
Yeah, so that's how you write prose, right?
I used to write a lot of poetry. I mean, I would love to get into creative nonfiction writing.
Okay.
Essays.
Yeah, that's where you want to hear it. That's where like all the money is, apparently.
Well, I'm one of the writers now. I feel like I don't need to do it for my career. So to me, it's just about fun. I recently realized this.
But it's so nice though when people like when like you can do it for your career. Do you know what I mean? Like when you don't have to, but like when like it turns out that way. It's like actually getting the Easter egg that has the good piece of candy in it.
It's like bonus nachos.
It's like bonus nachos. I mean, totally. It's like, don't ever say like you don't want that. Like whatever you say, don't say you don't want it. Don't, you can make that not the goal. And I think that's wise, you know, it's sort of like, I'm just going to finish this thing. I don't care if it's shit, you know, that I'm doing right now, but never, ever say you would never take that, because it's really nice when someone hands you a contract and says, write more.
I'll have to keep that in mind. Maybe jumpstart me, because I've got ideas in my mind, but, you know, I come home after a long day at the office, so to speak, and I'm like, I don't care about writing. I just want to watch and catch up on the Muppets this week, and that's it. Which is what I did today. But, Jill, I'm looking here. We are almost out of time.
Well, I'm really happy that you asked me to do this. I hope it's interesting and usable.
No, it is. And I feel like we've only just, as I say this quite often on the show, and it's true, I feel like we've only just begun to delve into the conversation.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, there's so much more we could get into about talking with my significant other, and she's like, ask her about this, this, and this. It's like, she is too fucking cool. And I'm like, I know, yeah. But before we go, you've got the novel out, Hausfrau, and, you know, available at major booksellers everywhere.
Yes, you can even download it. But if you do that, you can't write in the margins.
You can't annotate now. That's the big problem with ebooks now. Can't. It's no.
It is, but you know what? I kind of love ebooks. I really like. I have, and it hasn't impeded like me buying books. And I have plenty of ebooks that I also have like the hard copies of.
I know that I have a couple myself that I have the ebook and the audiobook. Perhaps even there's one coming out this month. I'll be getting the audiobook and the hard copy.
Nice.
Because the audiobook is read by awesome people, so.
Nice.
Anyway, so that's available, and of course, your other books, Harlot, your first book of poetry. But where can the folks find you online? If they want to check you out, check the work out and everything?
Oh my gosh, I used to have a website that I was, you know, keen on keeping up, but honestly, the best place to find me is on Facebook, which sounds ridiculous, but I sort of use it as my blog anymore, and I'm terribly clever. And, that was me being obnoxious. But anytime something interesting happens, I put it up there. And I don't put pictures of my cats up very often, which I know a lot of people find annoying. And I don't put memes up, which I know people find annoying. and I hardly ever talk about politics.
And are you on the Twitter at all or Instagram?
I am on Twitter, but I'm really bad about updating it, but I promise to get better. It's at JASBaum.
Are you on the Instagram or the thing?
No, that's for the kids.
Yeah, the kids today, they like the Instagram and the snapping.
Instagram and what's
yeah.
I mean, like, I don't even know what it is, honestly. I'm like, is it like soup? I mean, like, do you have to add water? I mean, like, when I hear that, I think of cup of soup.
It's just you add water and you have a gram.
I know, totally.
Instagram crackers.
That would be delicious, actually.
That would be awesome. Just here's a box of powder. Add water. Woohoo, graham crackers. There you go. $1 million idea right there. We just gave it away for free. Well, Jill, it has been a pleasure having you on.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for being here, and hope to talk to you soon.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
Take care. Have a good eve.
All right, you too.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.